Hi, this is Joe Roberts with OneWineDude.com, and you're listening to One Wine Dude Radio. Today I'm talking with Jamie Arahu, but not about her parents' fabulous wine estate in California. Jamie is the founder of a wine consulting group called Terravina, based in Paris and in Hong Kong, and she's the co-author of a recent report that's available for sale to the wine industry about the Asian wine market. Jamie helps us demystify the real reasons why the Bordeaux price market is so crazy in Hong Kong and other areas of China. And also, among other things, talks about what Chinese wine will start to look like when it hits the U.S. market, what varieties we might expect to see, and how all that will take shape. It's a really interesting conversation, especially if the only thing you know about the Asian wine market are the crazy headlines you've seen in most of the media. Let's have a listen.
Hey, well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Congratulations to the Steelers, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you know, I'm starting the day in kind of a mixed mode because I'm conflicted because the Steelers won and it was such a great game. So, I'm on this high, but my wife decided we're sort of doing a detox week, so I have no coffee.
Ooh.
So I'm on this if I seem psychotic and I'm jumping between like manic depressive states, you'll understand exactly why.
Excellent.
Won't take it out on you. So we should introduce you, Jamie Arahu, who folks will be familiar with your last name because your dad owns this tiny, you know, little winery in California. A couple people might have heard of that, right? But you are the founder. You have your own wine cred. This is why we're talking to you, right? You've worked in the industry. You're a WSET student. Oh, okay, sorry.
Oh, hang on. Yes, I am WSET. Good
Lord. So traumatic, you forgot, yeah.
And I created Terravina, which is a wine marketing and strategy consultancy based in Paris and Hong Kong.
Excellent. And you've just – the reason we want to talk is you've just released this report on a topic that has, I think, most of the wine world confused and stunned, which is the Asian wine market. So – the stuff that's grabbing
overexcited,
right? And the report is, you know, the purpose of our talk is not to get you to reveal all the secrets of your report, since it must have a lot of juicy stuff in it, because it's like $1,100. I said, wow, I can't afford that, but maybe a couple secrets, I don't know, but at least to help us demystify a little bit of what's happening in Asia from the, I think, more from the wine consumer, wine geek standpoint, because I think people are seeing headlines all over the place. It's just, yeah, okay, you know, we've got major chateau in Bordeaux. The first grocer, they're sticking Chinese letters on their bottles, and you hear about these incredible prices, and they're skyrocketing, etc. And the focus seems really on the highest end Bordeaux. Because that's what seems the salacious thing is grabbing the headlines. And, you know, every time I see those headlines, I think, didn't we already see this? Like, didn't this happen in the 70s? I mean, not in Asia, but in America, right? and the bubble burst. And, you know, but I mean, the bottom line, I guess the first thing you can probably confirm is, I mean, Bordeaux prices have disconnected with reality since 1973 or whatever. And they're never coming back, right?
I mean, I think it would be difficult to imagine Bordeaux coming very far back down, but for lots of different reasons. I think partially because you have a lot less variation today in vintages than you did 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
Whether that's global warming or whether that's technological prowess or whether that's the fact that people just clean out their sellers right now.
Right.
I think you could make an argument for all three.
All the above, yeah, I'm sure, yeah.
But there's a lot more, you know, it's not like you have a fabulous year and then a really crappy year. So I don't think that the difference in prices is going to be huge. And the problem is, you know, you put your prices up 50%, you get used to having that kind of cash flow. It's a little difficult to go back and go down 60% the next year. Now, the whole idea in Bordeaux is that is kind of supposed to be managed by the négociant.
Right.
Right? The sort of this Laplace, the system where actually the majority of the big wineries in Bordeaux don't actually sell their own wines to importers or anyone. They sell to middlemen who then go and sell the wines in market. And the middlemen actually buy the wine before it's even been put in bottles, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And so it's for a long time, it was a nice way for the wineries to just get their cash up front and for the middlemen to speculate and potentially make a lot of money or not, depending on how things went, the vintage. Now, the issue with China, and you're right, the report that we've just brought out, it's actually a joint venture between my company, Taravina, and Asian Palette, which is Jeannie Cho Lee, mm-hmm. who's the first Asian master of wine
yeah.
based over in Hong Kong. And the reason we actually did the report was because there's so much, like you say, there's so much hype and there's so much stuff going on and people talking about China and saying all kinds of things about it. And there are so many numbers you can throw out where China's concerned, that we felt it was really important, particularly for brand owners, to have some kind of basis in reality.
Right.
with people who actually work in the market, who actually know what's going on, and who can do a little bit of the reality behind all of the hype and all of the different numbers. So, and one of the things that I think, you're absolutely right about the U.S., having had the exact same effect on Bordeaux prices years ago, and the bubble burst, the biggest difference that I would see is that in China, a lot of the price pressure is being brought to bear not necessarily by people who are collecting wine per se, but by people who are looking for perhaps a gift for business acquaintances, or who are looking for a sort of status symbol, that kind of thing. And that means that you're ending up with a product, which is wine, which is actually competing with an amazing Swiss-made watch or a piece of art or other things that have a whole different price valuation system.
And that's similar to, again, the U.S. in the 90s, right, where wine seemed to jump into this luxury lifestyle.
But even then, you kind of had, I mean, at least the guys who were going after and spending ridiculous amounts of money on wine, it was like, I have to have a whole cellar of 100 pointers.
Or
all the top Grand Cru or something. It was wine related. What I'm saying now is that actually there are some people in China who will spend, you know, X thousands on a case of Lafite and have absolutely no interest or knowledge about wine whatsoever. They're not intending to speculate on it. They're not intending to resell it. But what they are thinking is that I know a guy who likes wine, and I really want to sign a $1 billion contract with him to build a bridge. So because gifts are very, very important in that culture, I'm going to buy this. It's going to cost me the fraction of what another top-end gift would have cost me, no matter how much I pay for it at auction. And that way, my $1 billion contract will come through.
Oh, wow. So that, great point. Because in that case, it's more like they're looking at these enormous prices. It's a bargain. Like for a wine lover,
exactly.
It's like, wow, I'll never afford this.
Yeah.
And I would argue to those people, though, you can't blame Asia. And I think there's an undercurrent of that, you know, that mm-hmm. some of these prices are going out of the stratosphere. And for reasons you're explaining, it might not have anything to do with them actually enjoying the wine. It has to do with, actually, that's a cheaper alternative, right, for them to get this business deal done.
Yeah.
But for wine geeks out there, they might be looking at that saying, oh man, it's the fault of the Asian market. I'm never going to afford these wines. And you know, my response to that would be that boat left the dock a long time ago. Right? Like,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's not, you can't blame the Asian market for that.
That way for years.
Yeah.
There are British people who are still bitter about the fact that they can't go over and buy on Primeur for like €5 because of the Americans.
Right.
So you're absolutely right. That ship has sailed. And I think...
you hear that, Brits? If it wasn't us, it would be somebody else.
Exactly. We'll still get blamed for starting it off. But And you know, I think it's going to be very interesting to see how it develops. Because, you know, there will obviously be some kind of market regulation as things cool off. And I think things will probably cool off as we go forward. But it's a very interesting time at the moment. And I think a lot of the excitement in China is justified. And I think a lot of it is absolutely overblown. And there are going to be a lot of people who are going to be very disappointed in the next 3 to 5 years. Because it's not going to necessarily save the rest of the world. And one of the things that I see a lot in my business with Terravina is people who are neglecting their traditional markets, who actually do quite a lot of volume for them, but maybe not quite so dynamic at the moment. And they're putting all their emphasis on China, where it's, at the moment, you know, it's the Wild West. There are some really great opportunities for certain sectors and certain kinds of wine, but for a lot of people, it's really going to be very difficult to make any kind of impression. And so I think, you know, when we start talking about, oh, a billion of this and 500 million of that, and even if everybody in China only drank a half glass of wine per year, we would triple world volumes and blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, yeah. But, you know,
every industry has been saying that for the last 10 years. And in fact, one thing that's interesting, in the press preview of the report that you sent over to me, one thing that jumped out at me was, you can say France and Australia have had this enormous growth there. So the reality is that that does not happen overnight, except in extreme circumstances there. And these businesses have been in that market for decades, and it's just now starting to culminate in something for them.
To pay off. No, exactly. And actually, I mean, I say pay off. I think your wording is probably more correct. I don't think anyone's going to see a return on their investment for a whole lot of years. And, you know, it's very interesting. A lot of the whole the volume things remind me again of the U.S. maybe 15, 20 years ago. When we started saying, oh my gosh, there are all these millions of people, and if all Americans only had one glass of wine
right.
per year, you know, we'd have all this volume. And it's like, well, you know, we're actually becoming a pretty sophisticated wine country, I think, in the U.S. And yet there are still huge swathes of the population who drink no wine at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And probably never will. And if you can imagine the disparity socially in China being much more pronounced, the exposure to a whole different culture. I mean, the other thing in the U.S. is that, you know, it's a melting pot of a huge number of cultures, but a lot of European cultures who had a wine culture. You know, China does not have a wine culture, really. I mean, they're creating one internally. And actually, I think a lot of the volume that's going to be drunk in China is going to be domestic.
Yeah,
it's going to be a big disappointment to some people.
Yeah, that was one thing I wanted to touch on with you, actually. Again, in the press preview of the report you sent me, you mentioned that there's a pretty large amount of production in China especially, but
yes.
That was this over 80% of the consumption volume is domestic. And that's, I guess, and even the stuff that's coming in imported it's not people drinking Lafite. I mean, they're drinking bulk wine.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount of, first of all, there's a huge amount of Chinese wine. And they're throwing in vineyards like you would not believe. You know, one of the things China has a lot of is space. And it's a country where, you know, when they decide to do something, everybody goes in the same direction, sort of thing. So not only do you have government subsidies, but you have these kinds of tax breaks, and you have these kinds of encouragements, and you have wine shows, and you have all kinds of different things that are helping the wine industry to grow. And, you know, the majority of Chinese wine at the moment is pretty much undrinkable. But there are a couple that are really actually very good. And it's going to be just a matter of time because they're putting a huge amount of money and effort into getting the best and brightest to come over and figure out how to do things better and really improve. And I think within 5-10 years, the cheap wine on the shelf is not going to be Chilean anymore. It's going to be Chinese, probably.
When you say on the shelf, do you mean in Asia or out, even outside of Asia, like in the U.S.?
Outside of Asia.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Outside of Asia.
Interesting. More competition is good. That's I'm happy about that.
Some people don't agree, but no, it's and so it's going to be interesting. Yeah, and definitely, you know, like in any country that has a major production, local production will always have a huge influence on the people, certainly in the area, and even nationwide. There's a national kind of pride. And there's also, you know, the national products, they understand their consumer so much better. Their packaging is more adapted. Mm-hmm. Their pricing is adapted. They know when to put what kind of wines on the shelf. They have the contacts as well to be able to make the deal with the supermarket or the wine shop to get themselves listed. So I think imported wines have a hugely difficult road ahead of them. And it's certainly, again, there are enormous opportunities. There's no doubt about it. But it's far from being as easy as some people, you know, as easy as saying there are 500 million potential wine consumers or something like that.
You can't discount the home field advantage, like you're saying. You know, I think, you hear that, Jets fans? Sorry, I'm... this will probably air way after that game anyway. But one thing I was thinking of was I think it was Simon Tan who at the International Wines of Portugal conference earlier this year, or I should start yeah earlier this year. We had a presentation by Simon, and he was sort of talking about some of the things that you kind of take for granted that culturally have very distinct meanings and can really hurt you, you know.
A great story.
Yeah. So I mean, he had one where he showed this picture of I think it was a New Zealand rugby team or something like that, you know, on the sidelines with green hats on, green caps.
Oh yeah.
And all the Asians laughing, you know. I was like, what's that? He goes, well, you know, it basically means you're a cuckold. You know, like, you're, you know, and so, yeah, so this is the kind of stuff you can't do, you know, when you come over to Asia, you have to understand that sort of, that, you know, how those cultural things influence the markets. And, you know, there's famous stories when the U.S. tried to sell, you know, things in Japan with, was it Pepsi or Coke had a slogan that translated to bite the wax tadpole or something. And
you know, the Pepsi, wake up your dead ancestors.
Oh,
the come alive with Pepsi was badly translated.
Oh, that's hilarious.
That was nice.
Resurrection drink. Yeah, interesting.
Exactly. Well, when you know how the Japanese feel about their ancestors, it's like, ouch, that was, somebody really should not have let that.
Yeah,
hurt.
not good. You know, one thing that I think Simon Tan also brought this up, want to run this one by you. You know, the markets. For wine seem to move with a middle class. So what I mean is you can get this a market for the high end for various reasons. And in China, for example, you're describing it as almost like a Rolex watch. You know? And then you can get, bulk or domestic market going for people who just want an alcoholic beverage, you know, at the end of the day from after farming or whatever, you know, so there's this, and in between, when you get a middle class going is when you can start to see the jumps, I guess, in what we would consider the majority of quote unquote fine wine sales, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess, a situation that's really starting to take more momentum in China, right? So one of the things that Simon Tan was talking about was maybe wine producers from Portugal and elsewhere, you know, have a chance to get in that tier of the market as it's starting to develop, right? There might be room for you, right? You don't have to think of it in terms of all the way on one end in bulk production, all the way on the other end in ultra fine wine. You know, there's a middle ground here, and that space actually hasn't quite taken shape yet. Would you agree with that? I mean, is that an area where people could actually be focusing efforts in the wine world and maybe seeing results in places like China?
Absolutely. And I think I think the only, of course, the only difficulty is defining premium wine in terms of price point, because I think there are pretty much as many definitions as there are people who talk about it. Definitely, I think as far as the high end is concerned, you have, like I said, the people who, like you very well said, think of it as like a Rolex watch. You do have a smaller but very fast-growing group of top-end buyers who are genuinely interested in wine and who are educating themselves at a rate of knots. I mean, really, really very fast. But they, of course, those are going to remain very, very small categories. The entry level, the only thing is in China, while there has been a press from the government, for example, to encourage wine drinking as a healthy option in comparison to the sort of rice spirit, the baijiu, mm-hmm. which is kind of like jet fuel. and so, you know, wine has been very much encouraged as the healthy drink to have instead of spirits. What we would consider entry-level wines are still going to be pretty expensive for your average middle-class person. And so I think there is certainly a middle class that is growing. I think the upper middle class and the sort of bottom end of the luxury segment is going to be where people who have a more premium brand will really find a sweet spot. And the interesting thing there for me is that you're talking about a sector who a lot of the times has spent time in the West, or they see a lot of Western things. They're really interested in a lot of the luxury end of things in terms of Western culture, Western icons, Western images. But at the same time, they're very much attached to China and being Chinese. And so they're finding ways to meld the two. And it's really fascinating to me. I think the luxury brands, like all the handbag and luxury goods, Dior, Vuitton, Hermes, have all figured this one out and are doing a great job. My favorite, I think, was one of the Dior adverts recently that has, you know, their French woman standard bearer model, who is in the ad, but it's shot in Shanghai with the Shanghai Tower. And the man in the ad is actually a top Chinese actor. So they've got this kind of, okay, we're French, we're incredibly sophisticated, you want to buy it because it's European and stylish, but it also has a Chinese connection. Mm. And I don't quite know, I think, sadly, a lot of the wineries who are looking at China are really only just starting to think about export as something they really need to get their heads around and think differently about. I think for a lot of time, and this actually goes for European as well as American, as well as Australia. Well, Australia is a little different, but a lot of wineries all over the world, I think, for such a long time, people really sold the majority of their product in-house, in their own country. So export was all of a sudden, oh my gosh, I need to sell somewhere else. Okay, somebody wants some volume, I'll sell it there. But in terms of actually thinking about export as a specific, sophisticated and thoughtful approach and strategy, that's really pretty new for a lot of people.
And now just even more complicated and complex.
Yeah. Now, obviously, well, see, I would argue that is potentially, it seems more complicated, but in fact, I think it's just as complicated to get it right going from the US to the UK as it is going from the US to China, in a way. And I think you underestimate the difficulty because things look familiar in some countries. But, I mean, China is more difficult for all kinds of other reasons that have nothing to do with brands or branding. I mean, it's difficult because of logistics, it's difficult because of relationships, it's difficult because of culture. In terms of doing business.
Yeah. What about the government? One of the things, you know, I've been critical of the Chinese government. A lot of people have, and I have no shortage of people on the blog telling me I got it wrong, which is fine. That's okay. I like having smart readers who challenge me. But, is the government a big factor in China with this market? I guess what I mean is, does it help, hinder? You know, not have any impact whatsoever. I mean, I think a lot of people have either misconceptions or general lack of knowledge of the influence that the Chinese government has day to day, especially on markets.
The Chinese government has a huge influence, huge. It's probably the most influential thing in the market, really. Because at the end of the day, they sort of pretty much control most things. Now, the difference is, are they on your side or are they against you? If they're against you, kind of probably not a good thing. If they're on your side, however, they can be a huge help. And I would argue that, because they've been really trying to encourage the wine industry over the last few years, it's incredible the amount of money, the amount of effort, the amount of initiatives that have been developed around the wine industry, around wine consumption, wine production, and that is really down to government support.
So it's almost like, I don't say totally open door, but it sounds like, you know, they're not maybe rubber stamping things at the moment, but pretty close because they want to promote the industry. So you're saying it's almost like they're on the fast track?
It's definitely moving in a positive direction. Obviously, you have to make a big difference between a distinction between mainland China and Hong Kong.
Right.
So Hong Kong, you have 0% duty. Logistics are very simple, very cheap, very easy, and the system is relatively sophisticated. You've got big wine shows that happen there. You have wine fairs. You have consumer wine events. It's a very wine-friendly place. And yes, technically it is Chinese, although it's a special, the SAR, special administrative area, administrative region. There we go.
We can Google it. It's fine. Don't worry.
HKSAR. But it is very different. Now, when you talk about mainland China, you have huge amounts of complexity in terms of duties, customs, logistics, and things like that. Now, they are working on it. They're getting better, and taxes have come down. But it's still fairly complicated. It's still fairly difficult to read because there are a lot of different rules, and it kind of depends on who you're talking to as to which rule gets applied. In terms of customs. So, your importer really is the most important person that you know in China because they're the ones who are going to be doing all of that stuff. And a good importer is more than crucial.
They grease the wheels. Yeah.
So, that being said, will it go in a more positive direction? I think probably. The only big issue that I can see coming up against that kind of development would be if the internal production started feeling threatened by imports and they turned a little protectionist in order to protect their local winemaking and wine producing areas, which is the case, for example, in India, which is why you have 380% tax or something on imports.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because with the headlines around the Bordeaux prices and Hong Kong auction markets, etc. You know, it's really really focused on China. Meanwhile, I think doesn't Michelle Roland have a consulting gig in India? And Japan is probably still the biggest thing going from a market perspective that area of the world, right? I mean, these are
Japan is a more mature market, so it's kind of leveled off. But Japan still sells more wine than I think all the other major Asian countries combined. So that's why I said when people are, you know, people and everybody wants to pour all of their marketing spend into China, and they're leaving, you know, they're like, oh, I'm not going to be bothered with Japan anymore. Japan is dead to me. Japan. And I'm like, well, Japan's still selling hundreds of cases of your wine. So maybe you should give them a little bit of love because, you know, okay, they may not be growing at an exponential rate, but, you know, three cases that grow at an exponential rate are still not as commercially interesting as 300 cases that are there every year. So, I mean, obviously everybody has to make their own decisions and work out, you know, how they place their spend and how much they take into new markets and how much they use for older markets. But Japan is certainly not dying. It's just not growing so fast because it's already done that.
Yeah, so it sounds like message for producers and brands out there is – you need, it's almost like you got to balance your portfolio in Asia, right? So you, the emerging stuff in China, take a look, start to get in there. Don't expect immediate payoff, but you can't ignore these other areas because they're producing for you now. Yeah, they're selling for you now.
Exactly. And, you know, there are, obviously there are big players who can afford to have the personnel to be able to do it all.
Right.
But if you're a little small producer, you may have to pick and choose. You may have to say, you know what, we can only do three markets in Europe and three markets in Asia or something. Or, you know, there's maybe one market that has one client and they take 400 cases and we can do them every year because it's easy. But, you know, you have to really be careful about spreading yourself too thinly because all of these markets need attention. It's pretty funny. When I first started off, a lot of what I was doing 6 years ago, 7 years ago, was talking to French producers about the fact that they couldn't just sign up with somebody in New York and then fly to LA and do LA and then fly to Miami and do Miami and then fly to Chicago and do Chicago and then they were done. You know, that all of these accounts needed to keep, you know, the contacts needed to stay open, the communication needed to stay open, and they needed to come back and visit, and they needed to maintain that relationship. It wasn't enough just to sign the contract.
Couple more questions for you. One is, in getting back to China for a second, do you, and getting back to the salacious headline stuff, you know, the really high end, do you think is it a bubble? Is it gonna blow up?
Is it a bubble?
Meaning
Are you talking about the major prices for big Bordeaux?
The latter, for sure. The major prices, big Bordeaux, you know, these enormous stuff going at auction, etc. I mean, it's so similar to what we've seen a couple times in the U.S. and other markets. I mean, you think it's just inevitable that the bubble's going to pop at some point?
I mean, it's fairly rare that a trendy product stays trendy forever. And at the moment, things like Lafite are very much the flavor of the month. Now, they have been for a while, and they are for lots of reasons that have nothing to do with kind of flash-in-the-pan stuff. They have to do with serious quality. You know, Lafite is one of the best wines in Bordeaux and probably in the world. Mm-hmm. And they have a name that sounds great in Chinese. They have had a lot of contact with China over the years, and they have made a real commitment to the market. So I certainly think they will always be present. They will always be a force to be reckoned with. The stupid, high, ridiculous prices, because that's not really based on wine drinkers per se. It's more either collectors who are just looking to collect anything, or people, like I said, who are looking for top-end gifts, those kinds of reasonings, I think, are definitely bubble-oriented.
Yeah.
So I think we'll definitely see. But that means that it's going to go, what's going to be the next? The next is going to be Latache, or some other big brand all of a sudden, you know, it could be anything, really. If it starts to get a huge amount of hype behind it and it starts to get value in the press and in people's minds, it could easily be the next big wine thing. I think wine is here to stay in China, definitely. I think it's a wine culture that will only grow and develop over time. But it will take time. And so people need to be able to get into the market. They need to be able to stay the course and really invest over the long term. I mean, one of the things people need to remember also about China, and this is kind of general about doing business there, is that relationships are not built in a day. It's the opposite of Hollywood, if you will. So whereas, you know, you could be best friends with somebody in 20 minutes over lunch in Hollywood, in China, it may take 2 years for you to even sign a contract with someone. And that's 2 years of meetings and phone calls and hard work and gifts and all kinds of stuff. Because at the end of the day, it's a very relationship-based culture, and relationships aren't built overnight. So, it takes time and people need to be patient. But certainly, I think it is a market that's going to have good wine consumption going forward. It's going to have increasing wine consumption going forward. And the people who can actually place themselves in that market and stick around.
Have the patience, yeah.
Yeah, we'll probably reap the benefits later on.
Great. One thing it's... for the wine geeks, right? One thing they've noticed is the big wine critics in the media paying a lot more attention to Asia over the last, you know, I'd say 8 years, and especially now in China. And how important are they in driving the markets generally there right now? And I'm talking not just about, say, Robert Parker scores, Wine Spectator type scores, but also within China. Are there, critics or folks within the media that covers wine there that are having influence locally?
To date, really, I haven't seen anybody in mainland China who has a huge effect. Mainly because it's a very, very, very new culture, and I think most of the people who are into fine wine are really taking their cues from international media, like Parker or Jancis Robinson. And I think that the younger generation, however, what's going to be very interesting to see is how that develops. Like your good self, there are quite a few wine bloggers in China. And
yeah, I've noticed some of them reach out to me, and their English isn't great, but it's going to be better than my Mandarin. And and I've been amazed because some of these folks are they're geeks. It's great. They are just as geeky as anybody else I deal with, or who reads a blog, or who other bloggers that I deal with in the U.S. I mean, it's fantastic to see.
Yeah, and I do think it's definitely a more normal mode of conversation and a normal way to find information for the under 40s, I guess, if I'm being generous. And probably under 30s, really.
Not by much, but I'm still there.
don't. we won't talk about that.
Yeah.
But I do think it's definitely a much more current mode of conversation, mode of information gathering, and I think it's one that will definitely develop as the culture develops. Now, Jeannie Cho Lee, who, like I said, I worked with on the China Report, she certainly has a huge influence in terms of Hong Kong and in terms of fine wine. But, all of the other, where do you find information in Mandarin on Jacob's Creek?
Yeah, yeah.
For example. So all of that stuff is really being taken over by individuals and by bloggers. And it's interesting too. I find a lot of, there's a lot of wine information on blogs that have nothing to do with wine. So the guy who's the head of Microsoft Asia Pacific, he has a blog, and it's mainly to do with technology, but he loves wine. So whenever he goes to a cool wine dinner, he talks about it and he blogs and tweets and, not tweets, actually the Chinese version of Twitter, because Twitter is not allowed in China.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of information that people who maybe aren't necessarily wine focused are getting as sort of collateral damage from just reading different people's blogs and information.
Interesting. And especially in there are alternatives, I guess, what you're saying. In a way, Japan has probably the most striking alternative with – is it Joe Satake? Is that the name with the manga comic where the guy's like – mentions a wine. It sells out.
Absolutely. No, I mean that was just – that was a phenomenon. That was absolutely unbelievable. And there's nothing really but again, the wine culture in Japan is so much more mature and so much more sophisticated that a manga about wine was much more likely to have success in Japan than somewhere like China, where it's all kind of brand new in a way.
Yeah, I guess it's a lesson in the brilliance of the idea and hooking into the culture, because you start a comic about wine in the U.S. and it's not probably going to move any cases, but do that in Japan and bam, it's selling out.
Are different. The interesting thing is that the other country where that manga has been hugely popular, and not actually so much because of the subject and the production side, but because grown-ups are comic mad, is in France.
Oh, wow.
Because comics are a big thing over in France, over here, because I'm in Paris at the moment. there's this huge thing for grown-ups. I mean, there's this whole massive thing of adult comics. And so the first thing they did with that manga was to translate it into French. And they sold millions.
Yeah, smart.
Definitely. Well, it also, I think it's also very... it's very easy to start talking about Asia as a place.
That's a big place. Yeah.
It's a big place. Kind of a lot of different cultures going on. Lots of different wine cultures, a lot of different sort of human cultures. And even within China, the difference between a first-tier, second-tier, and third-tier city is, it's enormous. It's absolutely outrageous. And if you think that China is like Beijing and Shanghai, then you're going to be very, very disappointed.
Yeah,
or surprised.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think one of the things happening, I guess, right, isn't you've got people who are in the cities who are actually looking to move just outside the city now, similar to kind of movements that happened in the U.S. and other countries, right, where it's like, oh, I need a break from the city now. So you're getting these secondary cities popping up, but obviously with different market potential.
No, absolutely. And, a lot of the second-tier cities are becoming really interesting targets for wine right now, because Beijing, Shanghai, the first tier is so competitive that if you are coming in with a brand that really doesn't have a big name, doesn't have a big image, you are probably more likely to do some really good, interesting stuff in a second-tier or third-tier city even, although third-tier... wine consumption is still, again, it's a little bit like the Wild West.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's almost, I know, speaking with...
Not until the garbage truck goes by.
Oh, that's okay. I can't hear it too, it's not too loud.
All right.
Talking with some producers in Portugal recently, they were talking to folks about getting into China, and said, oh, what's your Robert Parker score? Well, he hasn't reviewed the wine yet. I said, okay, well, then we don't need to meet. And since we're at the point where it's already like the competition's high enough, that's already creating that lazy market approach that you get with some retailers and importers, where they just go with scores and don't care about the rest, and it's sad. I wrote it's kind of a scathing piece in the blog about it, but I mean, to your point, the competition's already so fierce in the upper tier there that you're already starting to see that kind of behavior.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And, it's like, it's again, the parallels with the U.S. are, you can't go too far with it, but there are some that are really striking. And, you know, everybody always says, oh, I want to go to New York. Well, you know what? You really don't. Really. There's so much wine in New York. There's so much competition in New York. Really, your wine is not suited to that. And actually, I have a former client who was Portuguese winery, actually, interestingly enough, who do a ridiculous business in Atlanta. And, you know, when you think about it, CNN is based there, Coca-Cola is based there, they have the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually a pretty sophisticated second-tier city with a burgeoning gastronomical restaurant scene, whatever, and nobody goes there. So this guy's importer, every time he goes to visit, it's like Christmas. They're so excited to have him in market. They're so excited they want to take him everywhere. He gets to meet all the right trade people because there's just nobody else going to that market because they're also focused on New York, San Francisco, L.A., Miami, and potentially Chicago. But
well, you know what? I met an importer from that area when I was in Portugal. Guy, he's Ty Pennington's brother.
I never met their importer, actually.
The famous Ty Pennington, but I can't remember his brother's name. But he was great. You know, he was, say exactly what you're saying. They were really opening everything up to this guy, and he was clearly interested, clearly had a palate for his particular market. It wasn't about scores. It was really cool to see. But yeah, it's a great point. It's there's those secondary quote unquote markets could have big potential. It could. One more question for you.
Sure.
So it's not too late over there, but I don't want to keep you all day. But I'm geeky. I could talk about this stuff for hours. But one last question. For wine consumers, you mentioned we might start seeing at some point decent, cheaper alternatives to Chile, et cetera, right, coming from China. When do you think that's going to start, and what types of wines and varieties do you think we'll start to see?
Mm-hmm. I think we've started to see some really interesting things at the higher end. One that stands out particularly is called Silver Heights. Young female winemaker named Emma Gao. I think they did a piece in the Spectator on her just recently, actually. I had her wine, which blew my socks off. She's absolutely, it's a beautiful, beautiful, elegant, lovely wine. In terms of the actual entry level, until they really kind of get that moving and get it into, I mean, I would say between now and 5 years from now, there will definitely be plenty of decent, drinkable, entry-level wine to be had. Now, how long it takes them to actually move that into export markets is another question.
Mm-hmm.
For two reasons. One, because they may well have enough volume to satisfy within China that they don't bother with export. And secondly, because it may take a while before export markets actually feel like they can drink Chinese wine without, feeling strange.
Mm.
So I would say probably within 3 to 5 years, the volume will be there. And between 5 to 10, we'll start to see it in export markets.
Interesting. So be on the lookout. And any call on varieties? Is it mostly international?
It's mainly international varieties. The only really big different one would be what they call the Chinese Cabernet Grenache, which is an odd one. But it's actually in Silver Heights, interestingly enough.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Interesting.
But they tend to be – the majority – first of all, the majority is red. Just off the bat, because in China, red wine is the wine.
Yeah, is it a stigma against white being too sweet or something, or is that not robust enough? Is it?
No. Red is a very lucky color in China.
Ah, okay.
It's the color for weddings, celebrations, the color of New Year, the color of success and happiness. And like I said, the government has done a big push for the health factor with wine, and it's mainly been red wine. So even apparently there's this whole section of the population where you've got these women having a little glass of red wine every night before bed because it's supposed to help your complexion.
Oh, interesting.
It's supposed to relax you and help your heart and even help you lose weight and all kinds of stuff.
Interesting. So you know, it's funny because a lot of folks who know a bit about Asian market, they just readers who are saying, oh, you know, there's a stigma against white wine there. But it sounds like it's more like they're just ignoring it because they see more more benefits somehow in the red, or that's what's getting the attention at the moment. So it sounds is there's still a chance for white wines.
Absolutely. I mean, we could probably stop calling it white wine, which might help because white is the color of death. So
oh, okay, that explains a little bit more.
gold is good though. Gold is a good color. Yellow is a good color. So gold or yellow would probably be more helpful than white. And yeah, I mean, you know, all it takes is finding out that there's some kind of appetite suppressant or, you know, heart-based amino acid or something in white wine, and you have a selling proposition health-wise. In terms of actual marketing, I think one of the other things about a lot of white wines is that they have tended to be, in fact, not too sweet, but just the opposite, a little too acid.
Ah, okay.
Acid is not a huge benefit. Tannins, the Chinese are actually very cool with tannins because they drink tea, and tea is very tannic. So big red wines, no big deal. And the fruit and the body and the mouthfeel and all that texture is actually something that's very, it's more familiar to the Chinese palate than something that's quite thin and acidic. Mm-hmm. So whereas, you know, in the West, we can kind of think of a fabulous sort of bone dry Sancerre or Chablis or something with our seafood.
Mm-hmm. Love that.
For the, Chinese, for the Chinese, that would probably be a very unfriendly pairing. So another reason why champagne has had such a hard time, actually, is because the champagne houses, for some reason, refused to do what they did with the U.S., interestingly, some of them, which is do a special cuvée with a higher dosage.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, you know, they've done lots of studies. Basically, the Chinese love the bling factor in champagne, but they find it too sour.
Oh, interesting.
For brut champagne.
And that's a great. Thanks for that. It's been a really enlightening conversation for me about that market. And there's just another great example, because there have definitely been people speculating, just in talk, wine geek talk and blogs, etc. Oh, it's interesting. You get Bordeaux, but not champagne. Like, how come champagne isn't taking off there? There you go. Great explanation.
No problem. The bubbles don't help either, though.
The bubbles don't help?
No. There's no real reference point for bubbles in drinks.
Oh, carbonation in general.
Yeah. So it's not a happy mouthfeel.
Oh, wow. Yeah. They're missing out.
Great.
Yeah, that's fine by me. I'm not completely unhappy with the champagne prices, okay?
they're not
cheap, but they're not ridiculous yet, so that's fine by me.
Yep.
I can still get some of the best in the world for under $200 a bottle. Okay, I'm prepared to live with that for now.
Life is good.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
For anybody listening who's an industry peep, it's terravina.fr, right?
.com or .fr. You can do it.
And you can check them out. And they do have just because you're in France and Hong Kong doesn't mean that's all you do. You've got clients in California, right? And
absolutely,
all over the place. So, all right. Hey, well, thanks so much. Stay warm in Paris.
Will do. Yeah. Have you guys got lots of snow there, I think?
It's not a ton of volume where I am. It's just incessant. It's like we're getting yet another storm overnight or something. So I'm picked the wrong time to have a snow thrower that doesn't work.
Oh,
getting a lot of exercise. Yeah.
Stay fit.
Yeah, will do. Cheers.
Take care, Joe.
Bye-bye.
Bye.